Well, good evening and welcome to you. I am amazed at how a hush fell over the audience when the screens moved. I'm not sure what that says about us as 21st century audiences, but seems as though we're ready to get started right on cue. My name is Justin Barnard, and I'd like to welcome you to tonight's event on this Super Tuesday, which is super because you are here, and you're going to have the privilege of hearing a fantastic speaker on a very captivating topic. On behalf of my colleague, Dr. Micah Watson, who directs the Center for Politics and Religion, I'd like to welcome you to the talk tonight by Dr. Peter Lightheart. Dr. Lightheart is a senior fellow of theology at New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho. He has an extensive educational background, including a PhD in systematic theology from Cambridge University. And I learned tonight that his principal advisor was none other than John Milbank, which will be a name familiar to a number of you. He is the author of many, many books, and I'm always astounded to discover yet another book that he has written. And rather than read you a list, I thought I would just give you a quick soundbite or two about a couple of them that have been significant to me. My introduction to Dr. Lightheart's work came through this book, Against Christianity, which just has a captivating title, and you ought to read it for the title alone. But if that title is not captivating enough, what should grab your attention is his own description of the book. He said that it's a form of theological haiku. So if you are interested in what theological haiku might look like in prose form, I encourage you to pick up that book. And then another book, which has been significant in my own thinking and indeed in my own spiritual formation, has been this book, Blessed Are the Hungry. It's a collection of meditations on the Lord's Supper, designed to be read in preparation for communion in your local church. And it's really a deeply formative kind of writing, especially if you spend time meditating on Dr. Lightheart's reflections on Scripture and on the Lord's Supper. And then for those of you who are literature fans, he actually has a biography of Jane Austen. This is one that I cannot claim to have read, but my wife, who is a Jane Austen fan, has read it, loves it. She gives it her full endorsement. So this just begins to give you an indication of the scope of his work. And tonight, we are privileged to hear some of his work while it's in formative stages. He's beginning to work on a new project on gratitude, and he's going to be sharing some of his initial thoughts as he begins this project on the nature of gratitude and its promise and possibility as a civic virtue. So will you please join me in welcoming Dr. Peter Lightheart.
Well, thank you very much for coming. As Justin said, these are preliminary investigations or preliminary thoughts on a project that I'll be working on throughout the remainder of this year, something that I've been thinking about and teaching on for a number of years, but finally going to try to get my thoughts on paper. And I appreciate the opportunity to present some of this in its early form so that I can use you as my unpaid research assistants. I presented this material recently at Redeemer University College in Toronto and got a lot of feedback from faculty and students that gave me new directions for investigation that I wouldn't have thought of on my own. So this is a communal project. This is a reciprocal. You can show your gratitude to me by giving me sources. Let me begin with prayer. Almighty God, our Father, we are grateful to you that you are a God of gifts. We thank you that you are a God who eternally lives in a communion of giving and gratitude and giving again. And we thank you that by your Son and through your Spirit, you have caught us up into that fellowship. And that by your grace, we have received your Spirit, so that we can return to you our gifts of service and faithfulness. We pray as we study this topic together tonight that you would help us to see the breadth of this obligation of gratitude. Help us to understand more what it means to be your disciples and to understand the world around us and to operate and work in it more faithfully. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. H.L. Mencken was a early 20th century journalist in Baltimore who's best known probably for his writings on the Scopes trial and his writings about fundamentalists. He was a skeptic and a secularist and a mocker of fundamentalists. In fact, much of the popular conception, popular image of fundamentalism in our culture today is indebted to Mencken's work and the way he portrayed the ignoramuses down in, well, Tennessee, I guess, during the Scopes trial. Well, he was once sent a manuscript of a novel by a woman whom he did not know. The woman asked him to give commentary on the novel, and he initially refused, but she flattered him and continued with a barrage of flattery until he relented and began to read the novel in order to give this budding novelist his feedback. He found the novel wholly without merit. In fact, the veriest twaddle. That's a very Mencken word. It's full of nothing but twaddle. It's a worthless novel, and he wrote down that comment. This is worthless. Why did you waste the paper? And sent it back to the woman who had sent the manuscript. And then was initially astonished that she didn't respond with thanking him for the time that he had taken to read her stupid novel. Why didn't she thank me, at least for the effort and time that I took to give it my attention and to give her my honest feedback? But Mencken said that on reflection, he realized that it was not to her demerit that she hadn't responded with gratitude, but it was actually a sign of her strength of character. It's a sign of her virtue that she did not say thank you for the time that he had taken. And this led him into considerations and meditation on gratitude. Mencken decided that on reflection, gratitude is degrading. To express gratitude is a confession of inferiority and dependence. And it's degrading to the person who confesses that inferiority and dependence to somebody on whom they're dependent. On the other side, if you're giving something to someone, doing a favor for someone, in order to receive gratitude, that's the lowest kind of opportunism. You're trying to get fuel for vanity in the cheapest possible way. So it's actually a good thing. It's a sign of her virtue and her strength of character to show for this woman not to respond with gratitude. The ungrateful and incompetent authoress demonstrated the great instinctive sapience of her sex, Mencken said. That is, her liberty from the nonsensical delusions, vanities, conventions, and moralities of men. It's hard to find other writers who are as openly hostile to gratitude as H.L. Mencken. There are suspicions about gratitude that you find in various writers. There's a slight suspicion about gratitude in some of the writings of Aristotle when he talks about gratitude. When he talks about the magnanimous man remembers the things, the favors he has done, doesn't remember as clearly the favors done for him. And when he is indebted, he very quickly tries to get out of that debt so as not to be in a relationship of dependence. Like Mencken, Aristotle recognized that to be in a position of reception is to be in a position of dependence on someone else, and it's best to handle those debts of gratitude as quickly as possible, not out of gratitude, but in order to escape that relationship of dependence. More recently, Jacques Derrida, known as the father of deconstruction, has raised questions about the legitimacy of gift giving. He has talks about what he calls the pure gift. The pure gift is a gift that's given without any expectation of return. Anytime you give a gift with some expectation of return, even a minimal expectation of return, you've defiled the gift. It's no longer a gift. Instead, it's a part of an exchange. It's part of an economic transaction rather than a sheer gift. A sheer gift is one that's given without any expectation of repayment, but also without any expectation of thanks being given. If you expect someone and you're offended that somebody didn't say thank you, that shows that you were impure in your motivations in giving the gift. Gratitude itself ruins the gratuity of the gift. It turns it into something other than gift. It turns it into something that's an exchange, an economic, more like an economic exchange. There are a few scattered writers, a few scattered thinkers throughout history that have raised questions and raised doubts about gratitude. But for most of us, of course, gratitude is a virtue, and it's one of the earliest virtues that were taught, particularly in English-speaking countries. Margaret Visser, who has written a recent book on gratitude, says that polite native speakers of English commonly mix with others like themselves, may say thank you 100 times or more every day. Check yourself. I'm going to make you very self-conscious now. Check yourself. How many times do you say thank you? More of these occasions involve little or no, most of these occasions involve little or no grateful emotion. It's true, of course, that lots of English people fail to say thank you when they should, but the convention remains strong. In fact, precisely when people feel, as they increasingly do in our day, the mannerly behavior in general is on the way out, as they become less and less willing to enact the previously ordained formalities that constitute politeness, the few rules that do remain take on unprecedented force. Say thank you is one of these remaining rules. Thanking in English is like greeting, apologizing, and politely requesting, in that it is achieved by means of what linguists call conversational routines. These include conventional phrases, ironclad in their invariability, commonly said in a preordained order, often hard to account for through traditional grammar. English speakers, she says, particularly are in the habit of saying thank you, and children are taught from a very early age to say thank you. She has some studies that indicate how frequently parents reinforce this. And it's not just a virtue in popular life, even in our own day, but it's been a topic of reflection and a topic of attention by philosophers and even political philosophers for many centuries. It was in the ancient world. A little bit later this evening, I'm going to summarize some of the points from Seneca's treatise on the benefits, which is the single extant treatise on benefits and gratitude that we have from the ancient world, but it was by no means the only one written. We know from various scattered remarks elsewhere that there were dozens of treatises on gratitude and on benefits that were written by various philosophers throughout in the ancient world. It just happens that the only one we have is Seneca's. Plato wrote on gratitude in some of his dialogues, and other Stoics wrote on gratitude. Epicurus wrote on gratitude, and philosophers from other schools. And this remained a topic of importance for philosophers and also for political philosophers up until the early modern period. In the 16th or 17th century, I believe it's the late 16th century, one William Golding translated Seneca's On the Benefits so that it was available through Elizabethan, in an English translation throughout the Elizabethan period. Thomas Eliot, during the same period, wrote a manual for princes, a mirror for princes giving instruction to kings on how they should rule. And this included a discussion of how to cultivate gratitude among the people that you're ruling and how to show gratitude to the people for the benefits that they give to the king, and also how to stave off the dangers of ingratitude. So in discussing Thomas Eliot, in discussing political matters, how to rule well, he has to deal with the topic of gratitude and its inverse, ingratitude. In his Discourses on Livy, in the first book of the Discourses on Livy, Machiavelli describes how a prince should avoid being gripped with ingratitude and showing ingratitude to subordinates. He says this: a prince, to avoid the necessity of having to live with suspicion or to be ungrateful, ought to go on his expeditions in person, as those Roman emperors did from the beginning, as does the Turk in our own time, as those of virtue have done and still do. For winning, the glory and the conquests are all theirs, and when they do not win, the glory belonging to others, it does not appear to them to be able to use the conquests unless they extinguish the glory in others, which they don't have known, they have not known how to gain for themselves. So the prince is best off if he goes out and fights himself. Then he isn't tempted to envy somebody who's gained a victory in his place. A captain, for example, who leads an army to victory, the prince might become envious and then show ingratitude, and that could be politically dangerous. What about the captain himself, Machiavelli asks? What should the captain do? If you're a captain under a prince and you win a military victory, how do you avoid the envy that might arise in the heart of your king? How do you prevent his ingratitude toward you? He says, to the captain, I have no precept to give then other than that which they should know by themselves. To the captain I say, judging that he will be able to escape the stings of ingratitude, that he must do one of two things. These are Machiavelli's instructions to a subordinate about how to avoid the ingratitude of his prince. Either immediately after the victory, he must leave the army and place himself in the hands of the prince, guarding himself from any insolent and ambitious act, so that he, the prince, is despoiled of every suspicion and has reason either to reward him or not to offend him. Or, if the captain doesn't want to do this, go back to the prince and declare his loyalty, then he should take boldly the contrary side and take all those means through which he believed that the conquest is his very own and not of his prince, obtaining for himself the goodwill of his soldiers and of the subjects, and must make new friendships with his neighbors, occupy the fortresses with his men, corrupt the princes, leaders of his army, assure himself of those he cannot corrupt, and by these means seek to punish his lord for that ingratitude that he showed toward him. So either cozy up to the prince, or you prepare for insurrection. Those are the options for a captain. It's the best way to avoid the dangers of ingratitude. Well, what happens in a system where you don't have a prince? How do you avoid ingratitude infecting the social system if you don't have a prince ruling and a monarchy? What happens in a republic? Machiavelli says this: as to a republic wishing to avoid this vice of ingratitude, the same remedy cannot be given as that of the prince. That is, it cannot go and not send others on its expeditions, being necessitated to send one of its captains. It happens, therefore, that as a remedy, I would tell them to keep to the same means that the Roman Republic used in being less ungrateful than others, which resulted from the methods of its government. For as all the city, both the nobles and the plebeians, devoted themselves to war, there always sprung up in Rome in every age so many men of virtue and adorned with various victories that the people did not have cause for being apprehensive of any of them, and there being so many and one guarding another. You spread out the accomplishments, spread out the honor, then there's less chance for envy to arise. Envy and ingratitude are all linked together, and when you have envy and ingratitude, then you have a potential for various kinds of social and political conflict. So right up into the Renaissance period, and right up, as we'll see, into the early Elizabethan period in Shakespeare's plays, gratitude and ingratitude continue to be an important topic of serious discussion, serious philosophical discussion, and even a political discussion, as we see in Machiavelli. At some point, that drops out. This is part of the research that I'm going to have to engaging in presently that is at this point unfinished. At some point, that just drops out, and gratitude and ingratitude cease to be important topics for consideration among philosophers. They don't show up in political treatises nearly as often until the last 30 or 40 years, partly under the influence of cultural anthropology and studies of gift-giving in primitive cultures. There's been a revived interest in giving gratitude as a political issue. But for a long time, it's not been a serious topic of consideration. I find that curious. I find it curious that you have this virtue, which is virtually universal. Every parent teaches their children to be grateful. It's not only built into our family life, but it is in fact built into our political life. All of our holidays are holidays of gratitude. We express gratitude for those who have died in defense of our country. We express gratitude for the founding of our country. All of our national holidays have this element of gratitude. It's a potent political force. And even if the word gratitude is not used, it's often appealed to implicitly as a basis for fulfilling political obligations, a basis for political duties. So it continues to be an important social and political force, and yet it's not a topic of reflection, so far as I've been able to tell so far, in a lot of modern thinking about politics. That discrepancy between theory and practice is intriguing to me and part of what I want to investigate in my study. It's similar to the discrepancy that we have. I mentioned last evening Paul Kahn, a Yale law professor, who talks about the discrepancy between theorizing about politics in the modern era, and particularly in the 20th century, and what actually happens in political life. Particularly, he says, the major things that are left out of political thought are sacrifice and love, which are huge political forces. And yet liberal what he calls liberal political theory doesn't have any room for those impulses and those motivations. Gratitude is similarly anomalous in the modern world. An important practical reality that's not reflected on much by theorists and by thinkers. Tonight, what I want to do is give a few glimpses of the tradition that I'm investigating as part of my book project, and then end with a few comments about what I think has happened to this virtue in the modern world. The glimpses I'll give you are a short summary of Seneca's treatise on the benefits from the Roman period, a short discussion of Thomas Aquinas's treatise on justice, where he deals with gratitude and ingratitude, and then a few comments on how gratitude and ingratitude figure into several Shakespeare plays. Seneca, as I said, wrote a treatise on the benefits, where he's dealing not just with gratitude, but with both sides of the exchange. It's primarily a treatise about how to give well. He says that his treatise is about how to give freely, how to receive freely, and how to return gifts freely. And for Seneca, this is at the heart of philosophy. For Seneca, being a practically minded Stoic, moral philosophy is the height of philosophy. The whole point of doing philosophy is not to have some kind of mystical experience or simply to have knowledge of the world, but to act rightly in the world. Philosophy teaches us, he says in one epistle, above all else, to owe and repay benefits well. Giving and receiving and repaying benefits is the whole point of philosophy, because it's the whole point, it's at the heart of human life, it's the heart of human morality, and particularly at the heart of human social life. Seneca repeatedly returns to this theme that gratitude, gifts and gratitude, benefits and gratitude are what bind a society together. He uses the image of a ball game. And I'm not sure, it sounds like a volleyball game. I'm not sure what kind of ball games they played in the Roman world. But somebody throws a ball and the person returns the ball, and then there's a return of the return. And then there's a return of the return. Obviously, the ball keeps moving back and forth as long as they can. That's an image of the way society works. You introduce 1,000 other people and you're bouncing balls all over the place. That's the network of society, is me serving you the ball, you returning the ball to me, and I return the ball to you. And I'm doing that with dozens of other people. I'm doing benefits here, giving a gift here, doing a good turn here, and reaping the benefits from all these directions. That's what creates a network that creates and reinforces human society. At other times, he describes this as a dance in which one person leads, then another person takes the lead, another person takes the lead. Sometimes it's a dance of several people where different members of the dance group are taking the lead at different times. All of these images are reinforcing, again, his basic insight that gratitude is essential for the health of a society. And if you don't have benefits and return benefits and benefits given again, then you have a society that's disintegrating. On the other hand, if you have ingratitude as the dominant stance of a society, he says this can only lead to homicides, tyranny, thievery, adultery, ravishers, sacrilege, treachery. Nothing, he says, not even these are worse than the ungrateful man. Ingratitude is the worst of the vices. And he thinks it's the worst of the vices because he believes that ingratitude is the source of all these other vices. An ungrateful person is going to be a traitor. An ungrateful person is going to be a tyrant. What does he mean by benefit? What does it mean to give a gift? For Seneca, a benefit is, as he says, a well-intentioned action that confers joy and in so doing derives joy, inclined towards and willingly prepared for doing what it does. It's a well-intentioned action. That means it's intentional, and it also intends good. He brings up some rather interesting stories about people who are intending evil against somebody who accidentally do good for the person they're intending evil. There's one story he tells about an assassin who tries to kill a king, and he stumbles as he's trying to kill the king, and the knife goes into a tumor in the king's side that the doctors had been able to cure, and it takes out the tumor and saves the king's life. That doesn't qualify as a benefit, however, because the assassin didn't intend to save the king. He intended to kill him. It has to be an intentional act You also can't just accidentally, you know, just walking down the street and lose a $100 bill and somebody pick it up. They're benefited by that. That doesn't count as a benefit. They have no obligation toward you to repay that because you didn't intend to do something good for them. It has to be an intentional act, and it has to be a well-intended act. And Seneca also describes it in terms of the mutual joy, the mutual satisfaction that comes, both from the giver who gives the gift, who gives the benefit, and also the one who receives the benefit. Both of them share in this mutual joy. He claims elsewhere that the benefit is not, in fact, the object or the thing that is given. When he talks about benefits, he sometimes is talking about money or actual objects that are given. Sometimes he's talking about favors that are done to smooth the way for somebody to get an advancement in the Roman government, for example. An example that he continuously returns to is ransoming somebody from pirates, which apparently must have happened a lot back in Seneca's day. It's an example that he keeps returning to. But when he talks about benefits, he's not talking specifically or directly about that object or that rescue, that action. He says the benefit is the intention. The business of benefits and return is carried out in the mind. If I give somebody a gift, it's not the thing that I'm giving them that is the benefit or the gift, but that thing is the sign of the benefit that I'm giving. When I rescue somebody from the pirates, when I pay off the pirates and pay the ransom to free somebody from pirates, it's not the payment of ransom that is the benefit or the release from the pirates that's the benefit, but it's the intention to do a good turn and do a favor for someone. That seems like an odd way for Seneca to talk about benefits. We think of benefits as something that are more tangible than that. But he has several reasons for doing this. One we could call the relativity of benefits. Seneca is aware that benefits are, the value of benefits depends on the situation of the person receiving the benefit. Somebody who's dying of starvation is not benefited by the gift of a farm. You know, next harvest time, you will have food. That doesn't help. Even though in absolute terms, that's a more valuable benefit than a loaf of bread. But in those circumstances, the loaf of bread is actually the more valuable benefit. And he thinks the only way to account for that relativity in the value of benefits is to say that the thing itself is not the benefit. It's the intention to do good to somebody. He also describes benefits in this intangible, mental, intellectual way because he's very struck by the vulnerability of benefits. Excuse me for that. Benefits are vulnerable. If you give something, an object to somebody, it can be stolen. Moth and rust do corrupt, right? Thieves break in and steal. But is that person still obligated to you for the benefit? Seneca wants to say yes, because you still did him a good turn, even if the thing is lost. If I ransom somebody, this is an example he uses, if I ransom somebody from the pirates, and he escapes from the pirates, but is later captured by other pirates, has he benefited? Have I given him a benefit? Yes, even though now he's lost the enjoyment of that benefit. He still has an obligation to repay that benefit. So he recognizes that benefits are vulnerable, that they can be lost, and he wants to preserve the relationship that's established by the gift of the benefit, even when the object or the good itself, the enjoyment of the good at least, has been lost. I think above all, Seneca describes benefit exchanges as exchanges taking place in the mind because he doesn't want anything to interfere with the flow of benefits and return gifts. And he's afraid that if you describe benefits in terms of things, and a poor man receives a benefit from a rich man, a poor man who has nothing to give back, then the poor man is going to think, I can't receive this benefit because I can't return it. I can't properly receive it unless I can repay it at some point. But if what he's receiving is the intention to do good, that he can repay easily with profuse thanks and gratitude. That's the beginning of a return gift. That is a repayment for the benefit itself, Seneca says. So even the poorest person, even the most bereft person, can repay a benefit done, and that keeps the flow going and keeps society interlocked with this this flow and this exchange of benefits. A lot of the treatise is concerned with the proper giving of benefits. What I'm more interested in is the proper reception of benefits, because that's where the issue of gratitude comes in. But he does have a lot of advice on how you give benefits. You give benefits with the proper facial expression. You can give a gift to somebody with a facial expression that says, I don't really want to give this to you, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. Or you can give it to somebody with harsh words about how they shouldn't have gotten themselves captured by the pirates, but I'm going to rescue you anyway. So you can give benefits in a way that actually cultivates ingratitude rather than a response of gratitude. And you should always give benefits in a way that makes it easier for the person to return gratitude to you. But he also spends a lot of time talking about the proper reception. What is gratitude in Seneca's view? It begins with a cheerful acknowledgement of the pleasure of receiving the benefit, a cheerful acknowledgement that's made to the person who has given the benefit. And he says, we should make evident our gratitude by unrestrained expressions of emotion, and we should express these feelings everywhere, not just in the presence of the donor. We should go through the streets and announce the generosity of our benefactor, not just say thank you to him, but tell everyone. He says, the giver should only generate publicity about his gift to the extent that doing so will give pleasure to the recipient. The giver shouldn't announce his gift. The giver himself shouldn't blow a trumpet as he's giving his alms, but the recipient, he should have a trumpet. The recipient should hold a public meeting. Some people express their gratitude secretly, off in a corner, just whispering to the donor's ear. This is not diffidence, Seneca says. This is a way of denying the gift. Someone who eliminates witnesses before expressing thanks is actually ungrateful. So the expression of thanksgiving should be effusive, and he gives a lot of examples of the kinds of things you can say when you receive a benefit. You have put more people in your debt than you are aware of, for example. Or, you don't know what you've done for me. Or, I will never be able to repay the favor. It's always better, he says, to receive a benefit with excessive thanks, overestimate how beneficial it is, rather than underestimate. You want to praise the giver, even if he gives you something that you don't really need. You never express that back to him. You give excessive, exuberant thanks. And this also involves paying respects in various ways to the benefactor. As you may know, great Romans would have their clients accompany them through the streets. As they walk through the streets of Rome, they would be surrounded by a little entourage of people saying, look who's coming, look who's coming. This is the benefactor, this is the patron coming. The emperor, of course, would have his little entourage, but all the great people of Rome would be surrounded by this little cloud of people who benefited from their gifts. He says, if you receive a gift from somebody, you should be returning thanks in that way. You should be publicly acknowledging the benefit. That's how you should repay. He also talks about ingratitude, improper responses to benefits. I've already read part of this passage, but let me read a little bit more. There will always be killers, tyrants, thieves, adulterers, rapists, violators of religion, and traitors, he says. But lower than all of these, is the ungrateful man. Unless, of course, all of these crimes actually stem from ingratitude, without which hardly any great crime achieves its full magnitude. Every great crime has some element of ingratitude embedded in it, and it only becomes a great crime because of that element of ingratitude. Everyone who is bad, he says, is ungrateful, for he has in him all the seeds of wickedness. Ingratitude itself has several sources. He thinks ingratitude is partly inspired by pride. You're ungrateful for the benefit you receive because you deserve better. Sure, this is good, but it's not as good as I deserve. It often arises from greed or ambition, which Seneca interestingly describes in terms of memory. Greed and ambition is an orientation to the future that is never satisfied with past benefits or present enjoyment of benefits, but is always looking for the next benefit. That's greed. That's ambition. And greed and ambition are inimical, he says, to gratitude. Another source of ingratitude is envy. Not just, I deserve better, but I didn't get as good a benefit as the guy next to me did. One of the interesting connections that Seneca makes that's picked up by Thomas and other writers on gratitude is the connection between gratitude and memory. Memory, he says, makes a person grateful. A person is grateful if they're constantly turning over in their minds the benefit that they've received, constantly meditating on the good things that their benefactor has done for them. On the other hand, the forgetful are never grateful. And that connection between memory and gratitude, I think, is crucial for Seneca's view of gratitude, view of ingratitude, and also for the way we can reflect on it in our own time. Thomas Aquinas, in his treatise on gratitude, a brief section of his treatise on the virtues in the second part of the Summa, the Summa Theologiae, describes it on, he uses Seneca, quotes Seneca a number of times, and describes gratitude under the heading of justice. Justice is equality in exchange. Well, there's a natural equivalence that you have between certain amount of goods and a certain value of money. There's a certain natural exchange where you have goods for goods. You have a barter system. There's a certain kind of natural equivalence. There are also equivalences that are based on consent. Those are the kinds of topics and the kinds of exchanges that come under the heading of justice. And gratitude is among them. Gratitude is a virtue annexed to the virtue of justice. To be just is to repay to everyone what they deserve. And to be grateful is a subset of that. It's to repay to those who benefit you what they deserve. This is the key passage in Thomas concerning gratitude. What is gratitude, he asks? The first element of gratitude is to recognize the favor received. The first is to recognize the favor received, the fact that somebody has done you a good turn and you recognize it as a good. The second degree of gratitude, the second element of gratitude, is to express one's appreciation and thanks, like Seneca was talking about, although probably Thomas would be a little more restrained in the way that thanks should be expressed. The third is to repay the favor at a suitable time and place. And Thomas is very careful to qualify that. You seek to repay the gift. If a benefit is done to you, somebody rescues you from the pirates, you owe them something. But if you immediately pay them off, then that's no longer an expression of gratitude. You have to find a suitable time and place to pay them. You can think about a birthday party where you receive a gift on your birthday. Mom gives you a nice gift, and you say, hold on, I've got something for you too. Or let me pay for that. Okay, it's no longer a gift. Then you really have gone from one kind of exchange, a gift exchange, into an economic transaction. And Thomas does see a distinction, like Seneca does, between those two sorts of exchanges. So you recognize the favor, you express your thanks, and then you look for the right opportunity to repay the favor. And the favor, Thomas argues, should be above and beyond what you've received. In order to be truly just, the repayment has to be more than what you received. The reason for that, he says, is because there's a certain element of gratuity in the original gift. A benefactor gives a gift not because he's obligated to, but simply out of his sheer generosity and kindness, out of sheer gratuity, a gift, the original gift is given. And you have to repay that with gratuity. You have to have a free repayment, a generous repayment. But how can you do that if gratitude is an obligation, if it's the obligation of justice? How can you repay something freely, gratuitously, that's also you're bound to repay? And Thomas says the solution to that is that you always give more back than you receive. Then there's an element of gratuity in your return gift as there was in the original gift. And then as the exchanges continue, of course, there's increasing gratuity. There's gratuity at each one, and there's a little tip added each time an exchange is made. Ingratitude, he says, goes through the reverse process. Gratitude builds from recognition of a favor to expressions of thanks to a suitable to repayment at a suitable time and place. And ingratitude is a degeneration in reverse order. So ingratitude starts with a failure to repay. You're given a benefit, and you stop looking. You forget about looking for opportunities to repay the benefit. The second degree of gratitude, the second step of ingratitude, is when the person declines to notice or to indicate that he has received a favor. So if you've received a favor and you don't say thank you, you don't give any expression of thanks. And the third and supreme degree of ingratitude is when a man fails to recognize the reception of a favor, whether by forgetting it or in any other way. And again, as in Seneca, we have this connection between memory and gratitude, between forgetting and ingratitude. And then he describes, in the end of this quotation, he describes the degrees of intensity of ingratitude. Since opposite affirmation includes negation, so you have gratitude and its opposite, its negation, is ingratitude, it follows that it belongs to the first degree of ingratitude to return evil for good rather than to return good for good. The second is to find fault with the favor received. You receive something, you say, it's not really what I wanted. It's not such a good gift after all. That's a degree of ingratitude. But the third degree of ingratitude is to esteem kindness as though it were an unkindness, not even to recognize that it was a favor, but instead to consider the favor to be something like an insult or some harm, some injury done to you, rather than a favor. Aquinas is insistent, like Seneca is. Seneca, of course, is a polytheist of sorts, and so he describes this, talks about the gods and how we should imitate the gods. Thomas says we should imitate God. Both of them are saying essentially the same thing in terms of what the moral import is. Seneca says the gods give benefits to the ungrateful, and they keep giving benefits even when people don't respond with any kind of ingratitude. Thomas says the same thing about the Christian God and says that we should be imitators of this Christian God. We shouldn't withhold benefits because we don't get a proper kind of response from the people that we benefit. Renaissance writers, like Shakespeare and political writers and philosophers of the time, frequently bring up gratitude and ingratitude in a political context. Shakespeare returns to ingratitude, the vice of ingratitude, quite frequently in his plays. Viola, in the play Twelfth Night, expresses a standard Renaissance perspective when she says, "I hate ingratitude more in a man than lying, vainness, babbling, drunkenness, or any taint of vice whose strong corruption inhabits our frail blood." Ingratitude is the worst of the vices. When Shakespeare talks about gratitude, it's often linked up with a set of other terms and concepts. Shakespeare's word "kind" in the context of in the sense of he's a kind person often means grateful. Unkindness often means ingratitude. And then, of course, Shakespeare, being a poet, begins to pun on those terms. Gratitude is kindness. Ingratitude is unkindness. Kind means several different things. It can mean being generous and nice to somebody. Kind is also a description of genus. And somebody who is unkind, in the sense of being ungrateful, ceases to be of humankind. They're no longer part of the human race. They become monstrous. They become monsters of ingratitude. The title of my lecture is taken from King Lear, where Lear describes his daughters as expressing monstrous ingratitude. And it's because of the way they've treated their father. There's an intergenerational obligation of gratitude. Lear, at the beginning of the play, you may remember, divides up his kingdom among his daughters. He's going to divide it among his daughters. His faithful daughter, Cordelia, can't express her love for him. The other daughters express this feigned love for him, and so he divides it between the two of them and kind of exiles Cordelia. But it turns out that those two daughters, although they have received training and upbringing and this great benefit of half of the kingdom from King Lear, show no kindness to him, that is, show no gratitude, and also they aren't nice to him. And as the play goes on, they degenerate into almost literal monsters. The climax of this theme comes when two daughters of King Lear, along with their husbands, poke out the eyes of the Duke of Gloucester in one of the most alarming scenes that you will ever see staged. It actually happens on stage. Unlike much of the gruesomeness of Shakespeare's plays is obscene, it's off scene. But this actually takes place on stage. You see the eyes come out if you ever see a production of King Lear. These are monsters. They become like birds of prey, and there are other animal imagery that's attached to these two women. But they become monsters because of the ingratitude. They cease to be of humankind because of their unkindness. That's in a family context. It has political overtones because the family happens to be the royal family. More overt political connotations come out in Julius Caesar, and particularly in Mark Antony's great speech, this great funeral speech concerning Caesar. I'm going to read a portion of this. Imagine I'm holding Caesar's mantle, his bloody mantle with holes in it from the various daggers that have just killed him. This is Mark Antony, who is taking Caesar's side over against the conspirators Brutus and Cassius. He says this: "If you have tears, prepare to shed them now. You all do know this mantle. I remember the first time ever Caesar put it on. 'Twas on a summer's evening in his tent. That day he overcame the Nervii. Look, in this place ran Cassius's dagger through. See what a rent the envious Casca made. Through this well-beloved Brutus stabbed. And as he plucked his cursed steel away, mark how the blood of Caesar followed as rushing out of doors to be resolved if Brutus so unkindly knocked or no. For Brutus, you know, was Caesar's angel. Judge, O ye gods, how dearly Caesar loved him. This was the most unkindest cut of all. For when the noble Caesar saw him stab, ingratitude, more strong than traitor's arms, quite vanquished him. Then burst his mighty heart, and in his mantle muffling up his face, even at the base of Pompey's statue, which all the while ran blood, great Caesar fell." What killed Caesar? Mark Antony says it was not the stabs of the daggers. What killed Caesar was the ingratitude of Brutus. It's the most unkindest cut because it is the most ungrateful cut. Brutus, who owed everything to Caesar, now turns against Caesar and becomes traitor. Ingratitude leads to conspiracy. Ingratitude feeds treachery. Ingratitude leads to political disorder. This is played out on a larger scale in another Roman play, Coriolanus. I don't have time to summarize that play. It's at a movie theater near you, perhaps. I don't know if it's actually come out yet. Probably quickly went through the theaters and now has gone on to DVD. It's a lesser-known play, but in Coriolanus, the dynamics of gratitude and ingratitude are not played out between individual characters, but between Coriolanus, who is the great war hero of Rome during his time, and the populace of Rome. And the populace of Rome is like a body that, according to one character, has become revolted against the stomach, the patricians, against Coriolanus, who is feeding the rest of the body. He's like the stomach. The food goes into him first, but then he feeds the rest of the body. The whole body has been revolting against the stomach. And ingratitude has turned Rome into an unnatural monster. These are a few lines from a character named Menenius, who is Coriolanus' mentor. "Now the good gods forbid that our renowned Rome, whose gratitude towards her deserved children is enrolled in Jove's own book, like an unnatural dam, should now eat up her own." The gods forbid, he says, that ingratitude should make Rome a cannibalistic mother who eats up her own children. That's in Act 3, but that's effectively what happens. Coriolanus is exiled from his city because of insults he makes against the people. They forget to show gratitude for the benefits they've received from him. He has no, he's very belligerent toward them. There's no love lost on either side. And Rome becomes the great mother that devours her best children. So a great political consequence of ingratitude. The Roman populace expels the one warrior who can protect her. Up until Shakespeare's time and for a time after, gratitude, as I said, continues to be a topic of serious consideration and serious political consideration. It does not, however, I think, continue to have that same role after the 17th century, into the 18th century, into the modern period, and I think into the postmodern period. And I think we have a number of ways that we can see that. Just take a few glimpses of early modern philosophy, early modern politics, and some of the dynamics of modernity, and we see that gratitude is kind of shoved off to the margins in this modern perspective. You think about the Cartesian philosophical project. Descartes begins by doubting everything he can possibly doubt. He doesn't begin by receiving the inheritance of his forebears. He begins by doubting that inheritance. Everything he can doubt down to his own person, I think, therefore I am. I exist. I can't be sure of anything that I've received, but at least I exist, and I can begin to reconstruct the world philosophically from that starting point. That's a foundational ingratitude. It's a methodological ingratitude. And it's not that Descartes thought ingratitude was healthy and good. He talks about ingratitude as a vice. He talks about gratitude as a virtue. But his philosophical method kind of institutionalizes ingratitude. You have a similar kind of thing in Kant's description of the Enlightenment project in his essay on what is enlightenment. Enlightenment is about growing up. It's about reaching adolescence and not taking anything that your parents told you for granted. That's what it means to be enlightened. He uses that kind of language of, doesn't use the word adolescent, but he uses the kind of language of outgrowing the authorities that have been over us and beginning to question them. The stance that you take toward those prior authorities is not one of grateful reception, but first of all, one of criticism. You critique first, and then whatever passes through the filter of your critique, then you affirm. But the critique comes first, not the reception. Hans-Georg Gadamer describes the modern prejudice against prejudice. I think this is a similar kind of motif. Or we can think about the kind of characteristic political movements of the modern age. The French Revolution, which tries to scrape off all the inheritance, certainly of Christendom and of the Christianity, and start everything over again. Year one of the revolution, we're starting history over again. Not a grateful reception of our inheritance, but a demolition of the inheritance that we've received. Forgetfulness of tradition is ingratitude by Seneca's lights, by Thomas Aquinas' lights. Refusal to receive a tradition, to honor the past by seeking to repay that past in some way, is an act of ingratitude. Refusing the sense of dependency that we have as individuals and as a culture, the dependency that we have on prior generations, the dependency that we have as individuals on everything else around us, that individualistic stance, the notion that we are self-created and self-made human beings, I think is a foundational act of ingratitude. That way of thinking about ourselves kind of institutionalizes a stance of ingratitude. I don't think this is at all improved by postmodernism. Seems like postmodernism is, from one perspective, the act of turning modern ingratitude against modernity. Now modernity has become a tradition, and modernity has to be questioned, and we have to set up filters for that. And that's this first stance to get toward modernity now is a stance of criticism rather than gratitude. So the question I want to leave you with, and the question that I'm the kind of existential question that I'm investigating in this project, is the question of whether we as modern and postmodern Western people have institutionalized ingratitude in our institutions, in the way we think, in our individualistic impulses. Have we institutionalized ingratitude and made ingratitude a foundational principle of our lives? Have we become, by virtue of being modern, monsters of ingratitude? Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Leihart. We have some time for questions, and if I can ask Dr. Watson to grab a microphone, we will make sure that your questions are part of our audio recording. And last night, we broke a 50-year tradition by failing to have a student ask the first question. So maybe we can restore that. I'm just joking about the 50-year tradition. But typically, it is the practice at Union University to have a student ask the first question. And so perhaps we have a student here tonight who wants to express gratitude for the gift that we have been given by asking a question.
Well, I am very grateful, Dr. Leihart, for your input here, because I'm actually in the process of expanding a paper that I wrote on gratitude in the patronism system in relation to 2 Corinthians 4, 13 through 15. Mm. So I was really excited to hear about this, and I'm glad I was able to be here. But I had a question regarding several things. But first of all, regarding Aquinas, you said that he said that we are supposed to exceed what we have received in our gratitude to our benefactor in imitation of God. But since God is the greatest benefactor who cannot truly be repaid, you know, who is man to give anything to God, because God needs nothing, like, I understand kind of how that works with man-to-man relationships, but did he say anything in his works about how that works in relation to God?
Right. Just to clarify, the argument about repaying beyond what you'd received, the reason for that is because in order to have an equivalent exchange, an actual just exchange, the return gift has to have an element of gratuity, or it has to be a free gift in some respect, like the gift that was originally given. So that's not a theological point. That's not about imitating God, but that's about an equivalence. Gratuity and free gift should be met with free gift. But the only way to do that, if you're already obliged to give something back, is to give more than you received. Just to clarify what his argument is there. I'm not sure I can cite a particular example of or a particular text from Thomas where he addresses the question of our gratitude to God. Certainly, he thinks we should offer gratitude to God. He also is convinced that God is not in need of anything that we can give, nor can we give him more than he's given us. So that would have to be figured in. That would just be a different the exchange there would be of a different sort than the exchange between human beings. But I don't know of any place where he addresses that specifically. Excuse me.
First off, let me first start by saying that I'm very grateful for this lecture. But
you'd better be.
yes, I am. But towards the end, you're talking about Descartes and how he started off by questioning everything, and how that almost institutionalized ingratitude. And that kind of got me to thinking, okay, so I understand that to wholesale reject tradition is to be ungrateful to those who came before it. But does that apply to rejecting certain parts, to questioning certain parts of tradition that appear to either not be working or to cause significant problems? Or is that an act of ingratitude?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't think that's ingratitude. I think it has to do with what's the initial stance, what's the context in which criticism is done. I think it has to be the context of reception, and that means, by that I mean grateful reception. And it's in that context that we can make proper kinds of critiques and criticisms. I think that's you can make the point kind of abstractly, but I think maybe effectively, that a grateful reception is essential essential starting point for any kind of criticism. You just think in terms of the gift of language. In what's the medium by which we offer that critique? What's the medium through which we offer criticism? That medium is language that we didn't invent, that we've received and we have to make use of. So even the act of criticism, I think, depends on a prior reception, and I think it has to depend on a prior reception of that's infused with thankfulness. Yeah.
What does that look like?
Yeah.
Critique with a grateful spirit.
Yeah. I can give some kind of general examples from the way I think it would work. I think it would, I'm a theologian, so all my examples are going to be theologically oriented. A Protestant theologian evaluating the Roman Catholic Church during the Middle Ages. What do you do with that as a Protestant theologian? I don't think Protestant theologians have been particularly good at this, but I think the first response is to say, what was God doing here, and how was the kingdom being realized here? I think part of that reception would be to honor, particularly when you're talking about Christian evaluating earlier Christians, respecting the sincerity of Christians of earlier ages. Luther's Shorter Catechism talks about obedience to the ninth commandment, requiring us to put the best construction on everything. We try to find the rationale for things that may look really weird to us, but what did they think they were doing, and why were they doing it, and is there a healthy motivation here? Even if we ultimately say, well, they were misguided, or perhaps in some cases we'll have to conclude that they are just willfully misguided or vicious, but I don't think we can do that without those intervening steps. So that's the kind of process that I would think be involved.
In answer to Lowell's question, I was drawn to the prophetic tradition. I'm a history professor. If you want to overthrow 250 years of slavery in this country, then you appeal to not tradition, which would obviously continue that bondage, but you would appeal to the prophetic tradition, which returns you then to gratitude to God for liberty and authority to overthrow a tradition which is unjust.
Yeah. If I could just, you may have another question, but I would just throw in something there. I think that's...
I did have another question, but go right ahead.
Yeah, I think that is an important dimension, another part of the answer that I would give. When the original reformers are looking at their immediate medieval surroundings, the late medieval church, they don't wholesale reject the Christian tradition in evaluating and criticizing that. They reach back beyond what they see as corruptions to even the early medieval period, back to the patristic period, and that becomes a standard for evaluating what's going on there. So you're still honoring tradition, but you're looking at deviance in the later tradition. So I think that move of reaching back beyond the immediate past to as a way of honoring tradition and also critiquing a current expression of that tradition, that's another way that you could do it. Okay, your question, sir.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to Aquinas too. Piggybacking on the first question, this business of gratitude being to repay to the original gift giver,
yeah,
stuck in my mind. Does Aquinas say much about gratitude which does not repay, but instead, what do we say, pays forward, for instance? Parenting is the obvious example. I give to my children things which they can never repay. It would seem to me that one of the best ways for them to show gratitude wouldn't be to try to repay me, but to essentially treat their own children in ways which honor God and are loving and just and so forth,
yeah,
and so on.
Yeah. Aquinas, to my knowledge, doesn't deal with that question directly, but Seneca does. He raises the question in a couple of typical Stoic moral conundrums in the course of his treatise. Can slaves benefit their masters? Can children benefit their parents when children have received life itself from their parents. So anything that they might do in return is obviously based on that prior gift. And he says, yes, slaves can actually do benefits to their masters. And it's another reason why he wants to say it's a mental exchange. So he gets past all the social status. Like a good Stoic, he wants to look at human beings more equitably. But also parents and children. But he says the kind of, and this I think fits with your paying it forward idea. So the way that children repay their parents is frequently by extending beyond what they've achieved. Seneca himself uses the example, my father gave me life, and I show my gratitude for the life. But he didn't give me a liberal education. That's something that I got on my own. He didn't do the political achievements that I, he's not responsible for my political achievements. That's what I did. But in achieving those things, I'm actually bringing great honor to my father because I'm receiving the gift he's given me and expanding on it. So, yeah, Seneca talks about that at some length. Can she double dip?
I think she can. Okay.
She's writing a paper. This is research.
Yeah, if I could get your research, that'd be great. Understanding God as patron or benefactor, and remembering how in the Old Testament and in contemplations on the Lord's Supper, God often in the Bible calls us to remember. And you said in your transition from Seneca to Aquinas, talking about how memory makes a person grateful. In your research, have you come across people talking about how God's call for Israel and for Christians to remember is significant in viewing God as patron?
I haven't come across that particular thought, other than in my own study of Scripture, because that's as you say, that's a recurring theme in Deuteronomy, for example. There's a recurring exhortation to remember, and that memory is supposed to stir up faithfulness, and part of that faithfulness is going to be thanksgiving. I think it's interesting that in the Eucharistic rite we have, in the rite of the Lord's Supper, there's a moment of, it's called a Eucharist, and traditionally an act of thanksgiving, a meal of thanksgiving, but there's a moment in that that's called the anamnesis, that's a moment of memory or commemoration. So thanksgiving and commemoration of Christ's death are going together in that. It's those two dimensions of that ritual meal. So I think that's an important biblical connection, but I haven't seen it linked specifically to the idea that God is patron. I guess you could say that in a general sense in Deuteronomy, Israel is God's son. Yahweh is the father who has delivered his son from slavery. They're supposed to remember that deliverance. It's like being delivered from pirates, sort of. You can remember that deliverance and be stirred up to grateful obedience. Yeah.
One last question.
Well, thank you again. You, towards the end of the talk, you talked about some different ways that postmodernity, just current times, has ingratitude institutionalized, and you talked specifically philosophically and touched on politically. And then you, in one of your other answers, started to touch on perhaps an example of in theology where there might be some ingratitude undergirding the way that theology is done. I'm just wondering, are there any other areas or ways that we do theology today that you might see this kind of problem of ingratitude kind of behind the surface or something like that?
This is a very, all those comments are very, very general, but I think that there's a, insofar as theology operates within a modern mindset, I think we're, there's an instinct to be, for criticism to take primacy. Biblical studies, the most of modern biblical studies outside of fundamentalist evangelical circles, mainstream biblical studies, has been criticism, starting with the stance not of receiving the scriptures as it's given and seeking to receive them as given, as a gift from God, as a means of communion with God, then the effort is to, you know, pry it apart, find the sources, distinguish P from D and G, J and E, and I think that's just a modern stance, modern mindset that's infected the way theology is done. I think you'd probably, again, it's a very general comment, but I think you'd find it all over the place. And again, I would cite Gadamer again. The modern prejudice against prejudice. There's a prejudice against any kind of presupposition, against any kind of prior adherence to tradition. Gadamer's whole project is to say that that's impossible. We can't think outside of those kinds of traditions. And a lot of other writers recently have done the same thing. But I think that's characteristic of the modern mindset that you'd find in virtually every discipline. Thank you.